This episode includes sensitive discussion about topics including miscarriage and sexual assault. Listener discretion is advised. If you or someone you know is experiencing intimate partner abuse, help is available. Contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233 or text the word START to 88788 or go online to thehotline.org.
I was not allowing myself to think about being gay, because if I thought too hard about being gay, I was worried that I would go down a path that would cause me to lose my children.
As an ultra-Orthodox Jew, Sarah Glass was raised to believe her purpose in life was to marry a righteous man and bear children, all to the glory of God. And on the outside, she was following that plan to perfection. But on the inside, something was pulling her in a different direction. It was traumatic, and she would have to risk everything to find healing. Today, Sarah is a licensed clinical social worker, a therapist with a PhD in psychology, and she's telling her story in a new memoir called Kissing Girls on Shabbat. Sarah Glass joins us now to talk about it. I'm your host, Blair Hodges, and this is Family Proclamations. Sarah Glass, welcome to Family Proclamations.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited too. I wanted to start with your acknowledgement section, and I'll just read a quote from that. It says, "I was afraid to write this book. The fear was visceral. For decades, silence for me meant safety." So let's start with there, because getting up the courage to write and publish a book like this that has so much self-disclosure doesn't mean that the fear necessarily goes away when the book's coming out. So I'm wondering how you're feeling about it right now. We're about a month away from the official publication date, and by the time people hear this, the book will be available. So is that fear still with you, or how are you feeling about it right now?
To be perfectly honest, I am terrified. I'm really scared. I finished recording my audiobook the other day, and then I just walked through the city in total freaking panic.
You're like, oh, I wrote that?
Yeah. I'm like, what? What was I thinking? Why? Why did I was very intimate and vulnerable in the book. And it is scary for people to read it. I'm no longer afraid of losing everything.
So that fear's gone, at least.
Right. Yeah. At least I feel safe in my life and safe in my home and safe with the people I have around me now. But it's still intimidating to put that level of intimate truth and personal truth out into the world.
Let's play a game of catastrophe that sometimes I like to play, which is like, what's the worst thing that could happen because of the book? And what are some of the best things that you hope could happen because of the book?
I love this. You're going to therapize the therapist. This is great. Okay. Give me a break from my own job. Worst thing that can happen, to me, the worst outcome would be that nobody buys the book.
Okay, yeah.
Because after, like, right, putting all this effort in and getting so emotionally naked, the worst possibility is that it doesn't even matter. Best case scenario is that I reach some hearts, you know, and I help make the world safer for other people who are like me in some way, or like the me that I was back when I really could have used a book like this.
What finally got you over the fear enough to actually write the book? Because the whole process has been scary. There's still some fears, but there was a lot of fear before, and we'll kind of go into why that fear existed.
Yeah.
But what was the thing that kind of got you through that, that made you be able to say to yourself, I can do this, I want to do this?
I think it was enjoying some of the liberties that I get to enjoy now in New York City, dating women and having my family feel free and my children be able to make choices. I just looked back at the world that I came from and at so many people who live in different kinds of closets, different ways, live under different stigmas. And I thought, I can't just stand back and just enjoy my life without at least trying to do something to help other people.
I mean, your career's sort of in that field too, doing therapy.
Yeah.
Like you're geared to try to help people live better lives. And my partner is a social worker and taught me this idea of the right to self-determination is kind of a guiding principle here. And it sounds like you kind of want to spread that. You've grown from that yourself and sort of want to see other people be able to experience that right to self-determination.
Absolutely. That's such a great way to put that. Yeah.
Well, let's give people a better sense of your background. So you were born into an ultra-Orthodox Jewish family in Brooklyn. So let's start there so people can get an introduction to the particular Hasidic sect that you belong to and kind of the basic worldview you grew up with. Take us to young Sarah and her religious world.
I was raised in Hasidic Brooklyn, as you said, and it looks exactly like what you see in the documentaries and what you would imagine based on like photos of maybe 18th century Europe. The men in my community wore like the fur hats and the long black coats. The idea is to differentiate themselves from the outside world and to maintain traditions from the past. And so our world just looked like a more ancient world. Women wore full coverage. They're supposed to wear clothing that covers their collarbones and extends to 4 inches below their knees and below their elbows as well. So that's like full coverage on their bodies. Mm. Married women wore wigs, and young girls also followed dress codes that involved covering their bodies. The community was extremely gender segregated. So I attended an all-girls school from a young age, and the boys attended all boys' schools. And the idea was that the boys and girls would be set up in arranged marriages once they hit marriageable age, which was anywhere from 17 and up. And then they would be introduced to a potential partner their family had vetted and get married and have children of their own who would follow the same path.
And what was the idea of God's relationship to the community? The reason I ask that is because you had particular views about your body and what it meant to be a woman and the power of your physical body and your appearance. So tell us some more about how God was involved in your worldview and how it affected your relationship to your body.
Well, we were taught that there's a little piece of God in all of us. And I will say that part, you know, I don't know what I believe about God right now, but I do believe that if there is a God, it is within all of us and each person matters. In terms of our bodies, it was that our bodies were just vessels for service of God. They weren't really personal things. They were on loan to us. And so if we did with them what God wanted us to do, dress the way we're supposed to, you know, interact the way we're supposed to, then we get to go to heaven and we get to be with God in eternal joy and pleasure and peace. And if we didn't do with our bodies what God wanted us to do, then, you know, fiery hell.
And like a literal fiery hell. This wasn't an annihilation.
Oh,
this would be like literal suffering. And you thought about that as a kid.
Yeah. And then like one of the images I got was that hell was freezing cold, like Siberia. And I personally hate the cold. So I was just like, I cannot spend an eternity being freezing cold. Mm. That's not going to work for me.
There's a part here I wanted to point out where you say you came to understand that your body was really powerful and that covering your body was a way to protect other people from your body's power. So as long as you wore long skirts and long sleeves, you would be protected from men, but you'd also be protecting men too. The idea was that like men are sort of sex driven, that this would be tempting for them. And so you were really taught as a woman in this, as a girl in this culture, that you had tons of responsibility for how men perceived you and what they would do in relation to you.
Exactly. We were taught that if men were to see so much as a flash of our elbows, that might inspire them to sin, to masturbate, or to have sinful thoughts, and that would then be our sins as well. Like we would both be punished, ourselves and the men that we caused to sin. That was a huge responsibility for a child.
I mean, it sure is. I love the idea of there being a piece of God in everyone. I think that's beautiful. But there was also an underlying fear. You talk about fear as a primary motivation in the community. And what did that fear look like? What were you supposed to do with that fear?
It was sort of this inborn fear of God's wrath. When we talked about the traits of God, it was like God was very slow to anger. But we were taught that God was slow to anger. But that wasn't how the stories went down. The stories we were told were of God's wrath. Some people believe that tragedies like the Holocaust were because God was upset that Jews were assimilating, for example. And the fear just went through and through to everything we were taught. Our teachers would use fear in the classroom. If we weren't listening during Judaic studies class, the teacher would say, "Aren't you afraid of God? What God will do if you're not listening to this piece of Bible we're trying to teach today?" So the fear was used to keep us in line. Can't think of a better, like, kinder way to put that, you know?
I love the attention you pay to this as someone who's been now trained in psychotherapy, because you also point out that this can be really scary for a kid, but there was also kind of a backwards comfort to this, because Your universe was very orderly. You had a pretty clear understanding of right and wrong and the fact that punishment would happen. And there was a kind of comfort in that clarity and certainty, even though it was really stern and fearful.
Well, I think that's the reason why organized religion is so popular. There's a certain clarity, and why cults become so popular, which I'm differing. That's like different from organized religion. But there's a certain comfort in just being told, like, this is the way to heaven. You do this, you're good. You want to deviate from that, you know exactly what your punishment is going to be. It's all really clear. You don't need to make a lot of decisions on your own. You don't need to grapple with your own psyche as much.
I wondered if you could read a little section from the book here for us. And before you read this, I do want people to understand, like, you were a believer, you were part of this community. This was your world. But also you had some questions, and I thought having you read this part would really be a good segue into what those questions were. So if you can begin there.
Still, I had questions. Hardest of all was to understand why I felt love that I was taught to hate. All love, except the love of God, was suspect. But one kind of love was singled out for extra damnation, loving someone of your own sex. I was taught that God found my desires repugnant, that they are unnatural and wrong. And I spent my days in prayer trying to understand, why would God create me this way? The excitement my friend spoke of, about meeting a boy and living with him for a lifetime, was a strange and unfamiliar desire. The last thing I wanted was to live with a boy for the rest of my life. Still, I was prepared to do just that. I knew that by giving my life to the service of my husband, I would reach closeness with God and receive his heavenly bounty, his love, his blessing. I would reach fulfillment.
You weren't yet 19 at this point of the book when you really had to start thinking about living with a boy forever, becoming partnered and creating a family. And so as you're starting to look to that next step in your life, you kind of took this detour, this unexpected detour. You found yourself in Miami. Now, this might throw people for a loop that this ultra-Orthodox girl would find herself in Miami with a woman called Dasa in kind of a romantic affair here. So how did the two of you even discover each other to make this possible?
So I was 19 years old, and I was teaching eighth grade students at a school in Brooklyn. And then this woman was brought in, this young woman, to be a guest lecturer to my students. And she walked in and started giving the lecture. And I just felt something. I guess I had gaydar before I knew what gaydar was. There was like this recognition, like, okay, there's a static here. There's a buzz. She was beautiful and inspiring and charismatic. And we shared a few glances. And then we went out for ice cream under the guise of, you know, maybe she'll, like, I'll invite her back to lecture to my class again. Mm-hmm. And before long, we were both dropping little hints that we had gotten ourselves in trouble by being alone with girls before in the past.
And so next thing comes to next thing, and you end up taking a trip to Miami together. And it's, to you, it's beautiful. You get to feel what it feels like to be close with someone, a person who you're attracted to physically and emotionally and intellectually. In the back of your mind, what were you thinking in terms of what rabbis would say about this? And this was interesting because there's kind of differences in how they might treat men who are attracted to other men and women who are attracted to other women. There's almost a little bit of erasure that is goes on in the community, almost like women can't be gay, like it's not really a thing. It's wrong, but it's also not really a thing. Did I pick up on that right?
Yeah. It's like if you're a gay man, you know, that's really, really evil, really bad. If you're a lesbian, you know, what are you even doing anyway? We don't even know if God really cares, you know, which does delegitimize the experience of women loving other women. And it is gaslighting. Mm-hmm. It did make me think that the desires I had were just not real. Because if they were real, then we would at least get like one line in the Bible, you know, saying that it was bad. But if God didn't even bother to acknowledge it, then maybe it didn't really exist. And maybe I was just making it up in my head. So while I did enjoy going on a trip to Miami and having a long-term relationship for months with Dasa, I found it really like effortless, you know, for my body to adjust to being with a girl who looked at me and who was soft and who I loved being near. I also, in the back of my mind, was like, this is temporary. The real thing I need to do is get married to a man. This is sort of like irrelevant. It's like a little game, you know, until the real thing comes along, which is marriage.
I mean, Dasa even wanted to maybe run away to California or do something else. And you were convicted here. You wanted to follow that set path of being matched with a man. And what was that process of being matched like? This is where Yossi, is that how you pronounce the name Yossi? Is that right?
I would say Yossi.
Yossi,
like
okay,
with a
great.
U.
Okay, so let's say Yossi.
Yeah.
This is where he comes in. He's the person you eventually marry here. What was that process like? Because it's not like, oh, it's not the dating world of like, you look around and you see who's cute and then you ask him out and then you might fall in love and get married. It's like, no, there was a process that you had to go
through. Right. I mean, you can't do that because I wasn't seeing any boy, like I wasn't talking to any boys. They weren't in my life. My whole life was gender segregated still, even as a 19-year-old. Mm-hmm. And so we had matchmakers and I went and visited the matchmaker. I was lucky to get an appointment with like a really good one after a while because there are waiting lists and all that. I went to see the matchmaker and she already had a list of everyone in my family, all my siblings, who they had married, what they did for a living, where their children went to school. You know, all of that was as important as who I was. Hmm. And I had like a little meeting in her kitchen while she was stirring her chicken soup. And she just asked me some questions. And then eventually I got set up with Yossi, actually not by that matchmaker, by a friend's sibling, who was like, this is a great guy from a great family. And then the vetting process began. Mm-hmm. My siblings called everyone on the list he had provided, like much like a job. There was a reference list of people who knew him, rabbis and friends. And then they called people who weren't on the list, who they knew through word of mouth would know his family, just to find out everything about the family. What do they do? What are their customs like? Are they as religious as we are, etc.? You know, and then our first arranged date was set up. And that was just a couple of hours in a hotel lobby.
And then there would be kind of a set number of dates too, right? Like you were only expected to go on a certain number and maybe you could get a little extension if you needed it. But the idea was you were doing a set number of dates toward marriage.
Yes. It was to be under 10. By around date number 5 or 6, you should pretty much know if you're going to marry them.
So much of this was new to me, the idea of the need to have a partner that comes from a certain family. So let's say you had a family member who was gay and like left the community or whatever. That could be a stain on your family's record that could come up. Your marketability as a marriage partner depended on the perceived righteousness of your family. For you, one of the things that settled your heart, it seemed to me, about Yossi was that he was kind of open to you getting a PhD. You were an intellectually inclined person, and the ultra-Orthodox community doesn't completely forbid those kind of pursuits. And so he was open to you getting a PhD as you were talking about getting matched. And that was big for you, it seemed like.
Yeah. I didn't want to compromise on the religiosity of my spouse, but I really, really hoped I could find one who was both devout and would support my career.
Also, at this time, you hadn't really learned much about sex at all. In fact, you describe a woman, Mrs. Levenstein, who's sort of like a bridal instructor. What does that look like? It's right before, it's basically like 2 days before you're married.
Yes.
And suddenly you have to learn what sex really even is.
Yeah, yeah. I felt really blindsided. We had a few bridal classes that were mostly about like the laws of family purity, which involved counting a certain amount of days after one's period before immersing in a ritual bath and then doing something sacred with one's husband. I learned about the something sacred, but I didn't know what the mechanics of it were. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand. I had never seen a penis. I didn't know what would happen during the sacred act. And I found out just 2 days before my wedding, and I was kind of horrified.
Right. Did it seem just unreal to you? You had no context for it. I can't imagine.
I had no context for it. I remember coming out of that meeting, and I was just like green. Like Dasa actually picked me up from that and she was like, are you okay? You look like you're about to throw up.
Wow.
And I was about to throw up. Like I couldn't fathom that that would be the thing I had to do with someone that I barely knew. I had only met him a few times and I was okay, like marrying him for God. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know that I would have to do those things with him.
No. And that could be traumatic for anyone, especially traumatic for someone who's queer. And then the wedding night scene is really harrowing. You got married, then you're there that night, and you're supposed to be engaging in sex. You just learned about it. And you kind of, you went theological in your head to just think of it as sort of a sacrifice for God. This was something you could do for God. So that's kind of how you tried to process it in that moment.
Yeah, and that's why I chose the song to walk down to the aisle with. I actually, all the chapters in this book are based on song titles, and now I have a playlist that'll be released on social media for the Kissing Girls on Shabbat playlist. The first one is in Hebrew. It's a song I walk down the aisle to. And the translation of the song literally is, I will build a tabernacle in my heart, and upon it I will sacrifice my soul to God. Mm. That would be my sacrifice. So that's exactly how I processed it. And then going into that wedding night, I just was ready to sacrifice myself.
And you describe the strange negotiations that happened after you tried to consummate the marriage. You found Yossi's on the phone trying to figure out if you successfully had sex or not. Like, he's having to talk to other people to even find out if what you did counted.
Neither of us really knew what we were doing. So, you know, if you've never had sex before, it's like trying to do a puzzle in the dark. It's like, what piece goes where, and did we get it? And how do you even know if the puzzle's complete? So we did have to call a rabbi the next morning after we thought we had consummated the marriage to find out if we did. And the rabbi had to ask some clarifying questions, like, did this part go here? And did this feel this amount of painful? And was there blood? You know, things like that to determine if we had actually had sex. Which, spoiler alert, like, we had not. And it took a little while longer to figure it out.
Well, in part because, like, it's a traumatic thing. And so that was a difficult part to read. I think it's important, though, because it speaks to the pain that purity culture put you through and set you up for that kind of traumatic experience, because you weren't educated about sex and because you weren't heterosexual. And both of those things just made for, it was very, very sad. Very sad scene. And it seemed really personal. So I admired your courage in talking about it.
Thank you. And I know this book is a little bit of an intense read. People might want to take it slow.
Yeah. You invite people to, like, pay attention to how their body feels as they're reading and sort of, like, breathe when they need to and walk away if they need to. And you definitely have the reader in mind. We're talking with Sarah Glass about the book Kissing Girls on Shabbat. It's a memoir that's coming out in June of 2024. And Dr. Glass earned a master's in social work from Rutgers University and a PhD in psychology from Capella University. Okay, well, being gay wasn't the only secret, Sarah, that you were holding on to on your wedding night. But you didn't know that the second secret was a secret. You thought that your partner knew about this. It was your family's history of mental health issues. And Yossi had asked why your sister didn't attend the wedding, and you said she's not in a good condition to travel because of her mental health. You kind of explained where she was, and his response was, if I had known your sister was mentally unstable, I would never have married you. What was it like to hear that in that moment?
I was really ashamed. I also understood him, because I understood that, you know, genetics were really important in a Jewish marriage. What we were trying to do was procreate for God's sake. That's what we were commanded to do. Mm-hmm. And I thought he knew. I thought he had been told about my family history before committing to the marriage. And so we were both really stuck, because I was stuck with somebody who I thought had informed consent to be in the situation with me, to procreate with me. And it turns out he wasn't informed, and then he was stuck because we had already gotten married.
I think it's really important to point that out, because your initial reaction was not, you know, how dare you judge my family, or that it's wrong to have that kind of ableist mentality, but rather an understanding of, like, oh no, like, he didn't know this and he probably should have. And now I actually feel kind of bad about this.
Yeah.
Maybe give listeners a sense of what that mental health history looked like for you, like the family you grew up in, what you witnessed as a child, and it involved your mom and sister and family members who struggled with mental health.
So my mom had, I think, what we would call in those days, just nerves was what we called it. She had the nerves. We were Ashkenazi Jews. She was first generation post-Holocaust. Mm. And there are vulnerabilities inherent in that. And she had a difficult time with adjusting to life as a mother of a large family. And then when my sister, Shawnee, had her first psychotic episode, And just please know all names have been changed to protect my family and to protect all the Orthodox people who are named in the book. When my sister had her first psychotic episode and was hospitalized at 17, my mother really fell apart. That was really difficult for her to see, and our household devolved after that. Not only did my sister get diagnosed with bipolar disorder and struggle with that for many years, my mother also began to struggle more outwardly with her mental health and was hospitalized a couple of times as well.
One question I had at this point was, Yossi didn't like call it off at that point, right? He said, I never would have married you. Would it have been easy at that point for him to say, oh, I didn't know that, so let's go ahead and void this thing? Or was he kind of stuck with it as well, stuck with it in quotation marks, because that's a gross way to put it. But
yeah, no, he was. And, you know, that's part of what I'm trying to talk about in this book is I don't want to blame him or even any single individual in this story. These problems are systemic. These are things that are happening because the system has been set up in a certain way. And that's why it's still happening. And so just looking at Yossi as someone who's a flawed individual, as we all are, wouldn't accomplish the goal that I'm trying to accomplish with this book, you know? So I do have so much empathy for him still to this day. I don't think he was trying to hurt me at all. And in terms of him being stuck, unfortunately, as a very like knowledgeable in Orthodox Judaism, reader might realize at some point in the book I reference that he was part of the holy tribe of priests in Judaism called Kohanim. Those are people who come from the like certain lineage in Judaism, and they're destined to serve in the holy temple when the time comes. Now, that special tribe of priests, like that's passed down through their DNA, they are not allowed to remarry after divorce. They're not allowed to remarry anyone who's been divorced. They can only ever marry a virgin or a widow. And so when we got divorced, I did put him in that situation, or he ended up in that situation. And so he was more stuck than someone would be by the regular stigma associated with divorce in the Jewish culture.
Okay. Wow. Well, I mean, 5 weeks into this marriage, you're pregnant. So that would have kind of forestalled maybe some separation at that point, too. At 6 weeks, though, you notice some unusual bleeding. And this is a hard part to talk about as well, because you experienced a miscarriage at this point.
Yeah.
And your reaction to this was to internalize it and blame perhaps your own sins and maybe even your behavior before you had been married.
Yeah. Yeah. I was taught like this sort of really linear correlation way of looking at things that went wrong in the world. The Holocaust happened because the Jews were assimilating, right? Like whenever someone was sick, we were told to pray harder so that the person would get better. And so if I had a miscarriage, the only thing I can think of was, what did I do wrong to cause that? And it was really easy to draw the connection to the sins that I had performed with my body.
Right. And you were so alone, too, because Yossi seemed cold in reaction to it. He was just determined to move forward. And this process of like, you have your period, you have your ritual bath, and then you have sex, and this is the opportunity to procreate, have a child. So he's just ready to like keep going. And what are you thinking at this point? Because you're still so young. Are you ready to be a mom? Are you wanting it at this point?
I did really want to be a mom. Somehow that was never a question for me.
But you have questions about the way that Yossi is participating in your marriage, because his reaction to you being cold about it kind of set the stage for what I see as sort of a recurring pattern in your relationship, which is during the time when he wasn't supposed to touch you because of ritual impurity, he would sort of just completely shut you out. And you weren't sure if that was like the way things usually went. And there's a word for this that you introduce us to, and I'll probably mispronounce it, but it's like machmir or something like that.
That's great.
So talk about how that worked in your relationship and how that played into your partnership.
He really like kind of took it to the next level. I think teenagers today would say he was being really extra, you know, like my kids would say that was so extra. He was, during this certain couple of weeks of the month, he was supposed to not have sex with me, right? So in order to not have sex, there are extra like guardrails that the law puts up, such as don't touch each other, don't cuddle. And that's to protect you so you don't feel tempted to have sex. Not that I would have ever felt tempted to have sex. You know, I was like so relieved. This is great.
Bonus.
I get 2 weeks off. Awesome. Perfect. But just in case one would be tempted. And I guess maybe he was afraid of being tempted, and he was very, very pious and very devout. So he must have decided at some point, if he doesn't look at me directly, during those 2 weeks of the month, each month. That'll protect him from feeling like a desire to have sex with me. And so he would just not look at me. He would limit his conversation with me, sort of mumble things down toward the table instead of connecting with me as a person.
It just seems so lonely to me. And you're in this situation. And then he drops this new bomb, which is that he doesn't want you to get a PhD after all. This was a conversation you had before you were married. And all of a sudden he's like, actually, no.
Basically, right. So actually, I asked my rabbi and we decided, or he decided, the rabbi, that it's not a good idea and you're going to get a master's degree in social work. And here's what will happen next. And you will be very happy, is what he said to me.
And you will be very happy.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this was the option that you had. So you go to Rutgers. This is how you wound up there, where you got this master's in social work. And your first semester at school is maybe the first time that you're really, other than some little vacations and some time away from home, you're really in the quote-unquote world. You're out in the world now. And this is when you start to realize why the rabbis and why Yossi were discouraging women from going after an education. What kind of ideas started to come into your head as you were getting educated here?
Like, oh my God, everything. It was social work school. So it's not even like I went out of the community and got a business degree. Social work school would be like the most lefty, like radical, democratic environment to put a Hasidic young girl into. And I was like maybe 20 years old by then. And, you know, I was exposed to so much, like even just seeing people right near me, sitting next to me in jeans, that was a culture shock. Mm. You know, I was like, wow, like these are people I know, like I know their names and they're wearing pants. I didn't know anyone like that before. And then I got exposed to the idea that not everybody's a Republican. You know, and I was like, wow, all these people are talking about these very liberal ideas like they're good things, when my whole life I had heard about those liberal ideas like they're insane or like totally sinful. I was exposed to people who didn't believe in marriage, didn't think that having children was a value that was that important, that it was something that should be optional. And all of that was both fascinating to me and really frightening, because it questioned the single-minded devotion with which I was trying to live.
Yeah, and it seemed like for a time you still really wanted to maintain that identity, and maybe there was a little bit of pride in being that the Orthodox woman in the secular environment. Did you ever have a sense of like, I'm really going to prove who I am here. I'm going to maintain my faith. I can hang with these people. That's great. But I'm also going to be this like super strong in my faith and kind of do both.
Yeah, like during my first year of social work school, I kind of shrunk to the side of the classroom and I was trying to fit in. And then I realized that I did better. Like I wrote better term papers when I wrote about the Orthodox Jewish community and how I wanted to apply social work concepts to them, because I was suddenly passionate and writing about things that I knew about a little bit more. And I started to wear headscarves to school instead of wearing my wigs always, and that I felt like more confident as a Jewish woman wearing that. Felt like I was showing off my religion instead of hiding it.
Yeah. And this is also when you became a mother. So you have your first child at this point. And as you said, like you wanted to be a mom. So there must have been some joy here. The process of getting there was painful and not enjoyable for you. But having a baby seemed to be kind of a light in your life at that point, too.
Yeah. I always just, I loved holding my babies and getting to take care of them. And, you know, that was a holy task that I believed in and that I found extremely meaningful.
Mm. And you said babies because you had a second one, and there was a push to just keep going, right? Like you were supposed to just keep having babies. And this was a time when you actually got to use some birth control, because the community leadership and your partner would say, oh, we don't want to have babies too close together. Let's space this out. And so it bought you a little bit of time as well, but you tried to kind of push that time out more and more, and that just wasn't ultimately sustainable. You eventually had to stop taking birth control, have another kid, and you're still so young at this point. And now your relationship with Yossi is getting more and more fractured here. So what were you facing as you maybe started to see that something might have to change in your marriage and in your relationship?
I started to realize that he and I would never have a meaningful relationship. We were two extremely different people. He was very, almost married to the law and to the rigidity of the law. And I was just really interested in the world. I wanted to be devout, but I also wanted to talk about emotions. I wanted to have thoughtful conversations about psychology topics. I wanted to think about, like, how would we show our kids love in these different ways? I wanted to talk about theories of parenting. And I was with this person who was more focused on what time is it? And is it time for this prayer yet or that prayer? What day of the week is it? And what does that mean in terms of our religion? And he was just kind of in this world of black and white. And I wanted to burst out and live life in color for me and my children. And we just didn't end up having that much to relate on.
And there's another just really tragic scene that you describe of rape, where he forced a sexual encounter with you that seemed to be one of several breaking points for you.
Yeah, and that was a really tough one. It's really tough to define, and just to get very upfront about it and direct about it.
Yeah.
I don't even know if I would define it as he raped me or as the community and the laws were responsible for me being raped in that moment. It was definitely sex that I did not consent to and I did not feel I had a choice about. And yet, in some ways, I don't think he felt he had a choice either. I had just gone to the ritual bath, and the law mandates that once a woman comes home from the ritual bath, you need to have sex that night. Otherwise, that's problematic. Mm-hmm. That's the law. And so I had just come back from the ritual bath and I wasn't feeling very good. And I also really wanted to use birth control because I felt like my marriage was on the rocks and I wasn't comfortable engaging in sex without birth control. And he, at the same time, felt like we needed to have sex that night because that was the law. And so he called his rabbi who said I couldn't use birth control and that I did need to go ahead with the act of sex. And so I didn't say no to him. Because that would mean saying no to God in my mind at that time, saying no to the rabbi. Mm-hmm. And so I did feel I was raped, but I don't know if it was by him, if that makes any sense. Yeah.
It does. I appreciate the fact that you're viewing it with a lot of nuance, and it's really difficult to talk about. And in your mind, you're just thinking this has to end, like regardless of whose fault it was. It didn't really see. I mean, we should say in that moment, it didn't seem like you were trying to assess blame and fault. You just knew something was happening you didn't want. So that wasn't even on your mind. You just knew this thing has to end. And sadly, your sisters, your beloved sisters, are siding with Yossi, or sort of like, oh, divorce is not. What are you doing, Sarah? Like, you need to reverse course. Don't break this up.
Exactly.
You call them your well-wishers. Talk about that. Like, there's well-wishers around. I think this can resonate with people in a lot of different situations where well-wishers, everybody's probably had some kind of well-wishers in their life. What do you mean by that term?
Yeah, well-wishers to me, you know, were the people that, like, after I made the decision to get divorced, their job was to come by and try to talk me out of it. Mm-hmm. And so they would come by.
Out of
out of love, out of concern, out of concern for my children, et cetera, and so forth. And they would come over to my house and give me stories of their own horrible marriages, to which I was like, great, like, how is this convincing me to stay in mine?
Right.
You know, now I'm worried about you and me. Because you're telling me some pretty, like, horrible stuff that's happening to you.
Wow.
I went through a series of that, and, you know, my sisters thinking I was crazy for wanting to get divorced. And me even starting to think, maybe I am crazy. I don't know, but I just can't do that anymore.
Right. It's almost like, oh, yeah, maybe I am crazy, but okay.
Yeah, I'll take it.
That's what I'm going to be. Yeah. Right. So people that read the book will get to see, like, kind of how the whole process is laid out there, how the community handles divorce. But we will just take a second to say the divorce agreement itself was penned within the community. This wasn't something that was done in, like, a legal court of law. This was a religious court that negotiated this divorce agreement, and it included a provision that would affect your life for the next, like, 10, 15 years, which is that you agreed that the kids would remain Orthodox, and that if you didn't raise them in that way, that you would forfeit custody of them, which to you meant that you couldn't embrace whatever you had had going with Dasa before, or you couldn't sort of fully leave the community, that you needed to remain in ultra-Orthodox favor and bring your kids up that way. And if you didn't, the kids would be taken away.
Absolutely. That's exactly, you really nailed it. That's exactly what that meant to me.
So it was a lot of terror there. Now you're on a tightrope, right?
Yeah.
You have some choices because you could have just ran off to California and left your kids behind. You could have started over. You could have continued to explore yourself in secret or tried to stay in the community. So what did the early exploration look like? Now that you're separated, you talk about these controlled explorations that you started kind of experimenting with because you did want to find yourself more, but you had to be so careful and walk the tightrope.
Yeah, it was so hard because here I was 24 years old. I'd gone to college, and so I knew that other people my age were drinking. They were partying. They weren't trying to get married, right? They were having sex. I also got the internet right after I got divorced, and for the first time, I watched TV. For the first time in my life.
Do you remember what the first show you watched was, by the way?
Yeah.
What?
Grey's Anatomy.
Wow. Was it recommended? How did you land on that one?
I don't know how I landed on that, but I sat down in the corner of my kitchen with this like one wire that connected from my laptop to the cable connection.
Yeah.
Like on the floor for hours. Wow. And watched every illegally downloaded, sorry, Shonda Rhimes, episode of Grey's Anatomy. And I learned that like, wow, like in the outside world, people my age were having so much fun.
Yeah.
They were wearing whatever they wanted. And I wanted to be a person in the world and to try some of that, like to live in my skin. But I was not going to lose my kids.
Right.
That was a non-negotiable. Yeah.
And so even though you dated a woman at this point in secret, if I remember correctly, you met on an app. It only lasted like a few months before you turned back to find a Jewish man. And you found that it was kind of tricky dating Jewish men, even the Orthodox ones, because a lot of the Orthodox ones even wanted to have sex, which was technically against the rules for them as well. So you're in kind of a hard situation where if you want to get back and maybe even marry a Jewish man again, you're in a game where you kind of have to play it and even like have premarital sex. And you find some leeway from rabbis that are even maybe a little bit understanding about how it works. So talk about how this negotiation worked as you were kind of dating Jewish men and figuring out what sex could be like, even though y'all weren't supposed to be having sex. And you were gay, so like it wasn't like you were pursuing it because you wanted to have sex with dudes.
Yeah, it was totally purely strategic at that point.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't think of it like that at the time. But
sure.
I needed to marry a Jewish man because that was the only way I could keep my children. Mm-hmm. I couldn't be gay like that. I couldn't be gay and keep custody of my children. Mm-hmm. So I dated Jewish men. My like kind of value in the marketplace as a potential match had been decreased by being married and divorced. Mm-hmm. Those things were seen as strikes against me as a person. So I had a few strikes. Family mental illness. Divorce. I had children. That was a strike. I had gone outside of the community for school.
Yeah.
And so I was really like damaged goods at that point. And the Jewish men who wanted to date me, those were men that were wanting to have sex. Mm-hmm. And I felt that that was something I would need to do in order to get one of those men, like the men who would still agree to date someone that was damaged goods. Also, like, to be honest, a part of me wanted to at least try out what it was going to feel like with those men before I committed to marrying them.
Yeah.
Because I now knew how terrible it could be to have sex with someone that I absolutely had zero connection with.
Right.
And so part of me was like, let me just like try this out and see if it's more tolerable and if maybe it can even be enjoyable. And so I did get like special permission from a rabbi to dunk in the ritual bath and to purify my body so that the sex I had with those men was merely a lower level of sin and not the kind of sin that would cause us to be cut off from God and from heaven for all of eternity.
And people might be surprised to know at this point, you're still not like thinking of yourself as being gay as an identity. You're still, that sense wasn't there yet. In fact, and you found some enjoyment in sex with men in the sense that you liked being appreciated.
Yeah.
It made sense to me. You're describing like sex could actually be enjoyable in some ways for you because you could see a partner enjoying sex and that could be, it could feel good to make someone feel good. So you were also still kind of not really like super gay identity.
Right. I still didn't believe in being gay, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's also important to note that I was monitoring my thoughts. I had been taught to monitor my thoughts from a young age. Mm-hmm. Some of the things that we repented for as sins on Yom Kippur was having sinful thoughts. Mm-hmm. So I was not allowing myself to think about being gay. Because if I thought too hard about being gay, I was worried that I would go down a path that would cause me to lose my children.
Yeah.
So I was kind of thinking still in, you know, just a narrow way.
Mm-hmm. And we mentioned that your family had sided with Yossi, but you did have a chance at this point to reconnect with your sister, Shani, who we talked about earlier that had mental health issues and who was in Jerusalem for much of the time. It was beautiful to see, be able to reconnect with her, but the beauty in this case really turned into tragedy.
Yeah. That's another reason why I wrote this book, is to highlight the stigma that surrounds mental illness in so many communities and still in American culture. Way too many people are embarrassed to seek treatment for themselves or their family members. My sister had bipolar disorder, and she was sent to Israel to receive treatment. Our family also kept thinking there would be a cure, which turned out to be a deadly thought that this could be something that could be cured, because that led Shani to go on and off her medications multiple times throughout her lifetime and to be hospitalized over and over and over again, you know, because there is no cure to bipolar disorder. It can be managed and it can be treated and people can live wonderful, full lives.
But she was seeking like a cure instead of a treatment, which meant you've got to find out if you're cured. And that would send her spiraling. And she had children as well. And you became close with them. So you're connecting with her. You do eventually get married here to a man you call Eli in the book. You decide to get married here. And people can kind of, we've already said kind of why you made that calculation.
Yeah.
And now you have to figure out how to blend a family, though, because you've got two kids. He's got kids. Do you have any blended family tips that you picked up on at this point? Like, how was that?
Yeah. I mean, I could do a whole like day on blended family tips. Yeah. I've worked with it so much in my career. You know, one of my main tips would be, as a step-parent, don't try to discipline your partner's children. Mm. I had a 10-to-1 rule for myself. I would make sure I had 10 positive interactions for every one possible redirection of my stepchild. So I would be like, your hair looks great today. Thank you so much for clearing your plate. Your homework, do you need me to sign that? Here's a sandwich. And then there'd be possibly one like, hey, you know, do you think maybe you can put your shoes away when you have a chance? You need to balance that, because you haven't been their parent. So you don't have years of giving and taking care of a stepchild. And so when they come into your life as an older child, right, you want to show them that they're really loved and that they're respected as a person. You're not just there to tell them what to do.
You're trying to figure all that out. That's great advice. But as you said, it's like you could do a whole book on the topic. So you're learning all that stuff in real time, and you're in a new relationship. You're learning how that goes. We're not going to share everything about the book with folks, but let's just say that something really tragic happens that kind of causes a division between you and Eli. Something very heart-wrenching happens to you, and he sees you sort of pulling away from him, and he's frustrated because sexual access is changing. Your sexual relationship is changing, and this is sort of starting to fracture that relationship. So you finally got into this new family. You're financially situated, and you're trying to figure out how to be a stepmom, but now things are falling apart again. This is where a therapist kind of helped you. This is one of the most ironic parts of the book, Sarah, I have to say. A therapist, when you're being trained as a therapist, help you discover that you were dealing with PTSD, something that you couldn't see in yourself, even though you'd learned how to see it in others.
It's the wildest thing in the world. Being like kind of, I would say I'm like reasonably good at my job. Yeah. Like people do come and see me for psychotherapy.
Yeah.
And then sometimes I have these huge blind spots with my own self. And I'm like, what? Oh my God, that's what I'm doing. Right. I have PTSD.
Right.
Yeah.
And the therapist asks you a question, because you're talking kind of about your sexual relationship and sexual history and stuff. And the therapist says, Sarah, have you ever actually wanted to have sex with a man? And this was kind of a light bulb moment for you to really have to address that.
Yeah. I did not know that I was allowed to want, period, to want anything.
Mm.
I wasn't allowed to decide, do I want children? Do I want a sandwich? Do I want to go to the bookstore on a Saturday? Want wasn't really a big part of my vocabulary at all.
Mm.
So many of the things I did every single day were things that the question is really, should I? Should I want this?
Mm-hmm.
And then I would decide if it's something I wanted. And so when he said, have you ever wanted to have sex with a man? I was like, oh, damn, that's something I'm supposed to have an opinion about.
Mm.
I didn't think that was in that category. I thought that was a thing I should just do.
This is going to, again, set you down a path, because this is a second divorce for you. Did you worry about that? Was this like another bad mark on your record of like, okay, this is a second failed marriage. Did you have self-doubts about yourself of like, hey, this is another quote unquote failed marriage? Am I the problem? Like, what was your feelings going into that second divorce?
You know what? I really at that point stopped caring what people thought. I was just so done. And I had been working as a therapist for quite some time by then. Mm-hmm. I knew that too many people stay in bad relationships because they are afraid of what people think. And they put themselves through and their families through so much bitterness and resentment and anger. And I see the damage, like to this day, you know, I see the damage on families, on partners, on children when people make those decisions. And by that point, yes, it was going to be a second divorce. And I did not care what people would think. I was just like, this is what's right for me. I will hold my head up high. I know people will have thoughts about this, and that's really on them.
Yeah, you could take ownership. You become your own judge and advocate rather than outsourcing that to the people around you.
Yeah.
This is also when you came to finally embrace the fact that you were gay. And what led you to that? Like, what did you experience that made you say, oh, actually, this is who I am?
Okay, so I can't believe I wrote this in the book, you know? I was like, I think it was one of the hardest things to narrate in the audiobook was like my sex scene, that one with a woman.
Yeah, and I have to say, by the way, they're very chaste and very sweet, but yes, please go on.
I'm still like a Hasidic little girl at heart. Yeah. And I'm like, wow, I'm like writing about intercourse in my book for everyone to read. Oh my God. The other day, my daughter was reading the book. And first she comes running out of her bedroom and she goes, you had a pink Coach leather purse. Where is it? I'm like, Jordan, that was 2009. I don't have it anymore.
That is gone.
And then she goes, here's a pen. And like, can you cross out the sex scene? So I just like crossed them all out for her. Because I, you know, she's like, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Kids aren't interested in that stuff yet. So, especially
about
their parents.
I don't really want her to.
Yeah.
Exactly. She's like, you look so happy to be doing that. I'm like, yeah, thank God you let me do that.
Yeah.
So what happened was, that was a little sidebar, behind the scenes, you know, I cheated on my husband.
Yeah.
I did cheat on my husband. I left our home for a weekend. Told him I went to a conference. Some people actually go to conferences. Don't always think when your spouse says they're going to a conference that they're cheating, you know.
Sure.
But I was going to New York City that weekend. And I went to Manhattan. I went to the only place I can find, like, on Google that was gay, because I didn't really know anything.
Yeah.
So I actually went to the Stonewall Inn, which is, like, this historic gay bar in the West Village.
Yeah.
I didn't even realize that it was like mostly men, but I was lucky because on like Friday nights, there are women on the second floor.
Okay,
so I went upstairs and I thought, I need to know if I'm really gay before I break up my whole life and before I put my kids through a divorce. I didn't care what anyone else would think about my divorce, but I did care that I was putting my children through another divorce.
Yeah.
And so I needed to know if this was the truth. And so I went, and I don't know how I did this because, again, I didn't know what I was doing, but I did get picked up by a really cute girl. And we had a wonderful night together that was transformative. It was the first time I truly allowed myself to be with a woman without holding back and without trying to stop, without trying to hold my heart back. Mm-hmm. And once I actually allowed myself to do that, I realized what my whole life felt like it just didn't fit right up until that point. And I just knew, like, this is it.
Yeah, I love this line. I was gay. I was 32 years old, and I finally knew 1,000,000% I was gay. I wanted to scream at the top of my lungs. I wanted to run in the morning light and twirl around with my arms out. So, yeah, this was an awakening for you. But it did take you really letting go to experience it. You had to be fully present in your body and with someone else who wanted to be with you to find that out. And you were 32 years old.
Yeah.
Wow. And now your daughter could read about it.
Yeah, my poor daughter.
Well,
she's 17, so
okay.
She's okay, yeah.
Okay, okay. Well, and you showed her where it was, so she didn't have to read through it.
Yeah.
That's Sarah Glass, a psychotherapist and writer in New York City. She earned her master's in social work from Rutgers and a PhD in psychology from Capella. I should mention she's also a clinical director of Soul Wellness NYC, a private psychotherapy practice in Midtown Manhattan, and serves as a clinical supervisor for Jewish Queer Youth, a nonprofit that supports and empowers LGBTQ youth. We're talking about her book, Kissing Girls on Shabbat. It's an excellent memoir. You can also follow Sarah on social media. She has a great presence on Instagram. I haven't checked if you have a TikTok. Are you on there?
No.
I'm not either. I feel like I'm too old.
Yeah, I don't know. I just can't. I don't know how to dance or sing. Like, I just can't do
and I
it.
Don't know how to like get the algorithm going. I don't know. Okay. I feel you.
But thank you for mentioning the Instagram. That is where we'll put all the book updates, and that's at Dr. Sarah Glass.
Yeah. Okay, perfect. All right, Sarah, let's talk about you as a therapist and a writer, because your book also includes a letter at the end that you wrote for clients that you've had. You've had professional clients, so to them, you're a therapist. You're not a memoirist. And so reading this book, you tell them, hey, you might encounter someone in this book that doesn't match the impression that you have of me in our professional relationship, as me as your therapist. So you kind of wanted to give a heads up and acknowledge that, because the traditional role of a therapist is to have a little bit of a wall between you, maybe not even a little bit of a wall, but like basically separate your personal life out from what you're doing with your client. Uh-huh. Self-disclosure has been seen as kind of inappropriate. And so let's talk about that and how you're negotiating with that as a professional therapist, but now also someone who's telling your story so publicly.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting thing to think about. I even have so much self-judgment still as you're queuing up this question to ask me. My inner old therapist judgment voice is like sort of shaming me for writing a book. Still to this day. But I did want to include a letter to my clients in the book because I wanted them to know how thoughtful I was when I made the decision to write. And so I'll share a little bit of my thought process. And I don't know if this is the only way to be. It definitely isn't. This is just the process that I went through. Mm-hmm. And part of my thought process was this. When I was initially trained as a therapist, the father of psychotherapy was Freud. Right. And Freud had this whole idea that therapists are just this blank slate. We're supposed to just be like this mirror. Clients come in, they tell us all their vulnerable things. They can cry, they can laugh, they can question, and we are supposed to remain blank. That was something I did for a while. Mm-hmm. And I always felt like it was a little bit disingenuous. And it was almost like clients would be going through all these emotional experiences and then looking at me, and it was like, I was in this like superiority mode, like I wasn't going to be feeling with them. It felt sort of like cold parent to me. And then when I got trained in trauma therapy, polyvagal theory, and somatic experiencing therapy, Van der Kolk's work on the nervous system.
Body keeps the score.
I learned that, you know what? Clients actually need to sometimes feel like there's a human being on the other side. Mm-hmm. Like it's not a blank mirror. That could be traumatic to have just this blank mirror. And that it's okay to laugh and to cry a little bit and to feel with your client. That resonated for me much more. I am a very embodied, empathic person. I am the kind of person, you know, that when someone's crying in front of me, I do feel it in my body. And so it felt much more natural to be able to be that. And as time went on, and I won't go through all of it that's in the letter, I just started to see different therapists, modern therapists, practicing in different ways, having social media presences, writing some of their own stories. And I started to think therapy was invented by men, white, cisgender men, from decades ago. From a time when there was no internet and a time when they could keep their lives separate at home and they weren't Googleable, you know, they were able to keep their wives at home bearing the children. And that maybe that just wasn't the only way to practice. Maybe therapists having to be a blank slate, like, A, that's impossible to do that out in the world where you're Googleable. What are we supposed to do? Have no lives that can ever be found online? How is that an oath that anyone can take? You know, it's unrealistic. And maybe that's not even helpful. Maybe it is helpful when people do see us as human beings. And so I still think it's important to have boundaries in the therapy room.
When a client comes into the therapy room,
that room becomes their sacred space. That's not a time to impose one's personal views, opinions, or anecdotes. However, that doesn't mean that therapists are not allowed to also be human beings out in the world. And maybe if we tell our stories and we're open about that, maybe that can help people out there. Maybe help people need less intense trauma healing. Maybe we can help people prevent trauma.
That's Sarah Glass. And I do want to say there's so much in the interview that we couldn't cover. There's some unspoken spoilers. You talked about your daughter. So people obviously know that the divorce and the way that you were able to go through things worked out in terms of staying close to your kids. But there's other things in the book. I promise people, we have not covered everything in this book. There's big reveals. There's big feelings and really big things that happened to you that we haven't covered. So I strongly recommend that people pick up this memoir because we've really only scratched the surface here. The name of the book is Kissing Girls on Shabbat, which, by the way, my kiddo said to me, so does she kiss girls on Shabbat a lot in the book? And I said, you know, I actually don't remember any like actual Shabbat kissing.
Yeah, it was a way to like honor the intersectionality of this experience of being both Jewish and queer.
Yeah. Oh, it's a great title. I thought it was so funny that like question was like, oh, so she kisses a lot of people on Shabbat. And I was like, maybe, but not really in the book.
Well, now I do. Yeah.
Yeah, now. Okay, excellent. All right. Okay, well, Sarah, before we go, we always have a segment here called Regrets, Challenges, and Surprises. This is your chance to choose your own adventure, something you regret about the book. Now, it's coming out this next month, but that means like it's baked in, so maybe there is something you could change. Or what was the most challenging part about writing it, or something that you discovered in the process of actually writing it? And you can speak to any of those that you wish.
Well, talk about a challenge, because I think this will be helpful to anyone who's trying to memoir write. One of the challenges is that I actually wrote this book like 4 or 5 times. Mm. You know, the first iteration was really angry.
Mm.
And it was from a more flattened, one-dimensional perspective of me as victim of a terrible circumstance. And then I had to rewrite it and rewrite it until I could find compassion for all the players involved.
Wow.
And tell a more comprehensive story. And I loved that was the process. It was challenging. And also it was extremely cathartic to be able to go through all those iterations of the book and then to find a story that actually felt like it did justice to all the characters and not, or I hope, you know, all the characters, not just to myself. And also that like included my own flaws and didn't make me come off as some hero.
That's certainly true.
Yeah.
There's a certain chameleon nature to you, too, of always trying. I never knew where you were going to go next. I never quite knew where you were going to be. And so I should say right before we go, too, I'm not making this up. Like, I finished this book in Chicago. I was on a business trip, and I was in this hotel, and I stayed up till, like, 3 in the morning my time because I couldn't stop reading. I was like, I got to finish this book.
Thank
you. It's so good.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for reading so carefully and thoughtfully and like for asking such great questions.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Truly, Sarah, this has been a great conversation and there's so much more in your book. So again, Kissing Girls on Shabbat, a memoir. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Family Proclamations. I'm looking forward to the next episode in 2 weeks. You can send any questions or comments my way. The email is blair@firesidepod.org. Also, give me a follow on Instagram to get little previews of upcoming episodes. Look for FamProx is the name on Instagram. And if this is your first time listening, welcome. And I hope you stick around. Check out some of the other episodes or let a friend know about the show. You could also take a second to rate and review the show in Apple Podcasts or give us a rating in Spotify. And this is especially important for independent shows like Family Proclamations. I mean, it's how we build social credit and credibility. And speaking of which, here's the latest Apple Podcast review from Cynthia. It says, I've been a longtime fan of Blair's podcasting. He is always thoughtful and curious with his guests and loving this new venture. Thank you for that review, Cynthia. And also thanks to Camille Messick, my wonderful transcript editor, as well as Mates of State, who provided the theme song. Family Proclamations is part of the Dialogue Podcast Network. I'm Blair Hodges, and I'll see you next time.